We note, for instance, that tea appeared in the world, and its use spread throughout China. China began to drink tea in the 6th century AD. And there were Chinese poets to write delightfully about the effects of the first cup, and the second cup, and the third cup, and so on. China continued to produce beautiful paintings long after the fall of the Han rule. In the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th centuries, some of the most lovely landscapes were painted that have ever been done by men. A considerable production of beautiful vases and carvings also continued. Fine building and decoration went on. Printing from wood blocks began about the same time as tea drinking, and with the 7th century came a remarkable revival of poetry. Certain differences between the great empires of the East and West were all in favor of the stability of the former. China had no general coinage. The cash and credit system of the Western world, at once efficient and dangerous, hadn't strained her economic life. Not that the monetary idea was unknown. For small transactions, the various provinces were using perforated zinc and brass cash. But for larger, there was nothing but stamped ingots of silver. This great empire was still carrying on most of its business on a basis of barter, like that which prevailed in Babylon in the days of the Aramean merchants, and so it continued to do to the dawn of the 20th century. We've seen how, under the Roman Republic, economic and social order was destroyed by the too great fluidity of property that money brought about. Money became abstract and lost touch with the real values it was supposed to represent. Individuals and communities got preposterously into debt, and the world was saddled by a class of rich men who were creditors, men who didn't handle and administer any real wealth, but who had the power to call up money. No such development of finance occurred in China. Wealth in China remained real and visible, and China had no need for any Licinian law, nor for a Tiberius Gracchus. The idea of property in China didn't extend far beyond tangible things. There was no labor slavery, no gang servitude. The occupier and user of the land was in most instances practically the owner of it, subject to a land tax. There was a certain amount of small-scale landlordism, but no great estates. Landless men worked for wages paid mostly in kind, as they were in ancient Babylon. These things made for stability, and the geographical form of China for unity. Nevertheless, the vigor of the Han dynasty declined, and when at last, at the close of the 2nd century AD, the world catastrophe of the great pestilence struck the system, the same pestilence that inaugurated a century of confusion in the Roman Empire, the dynasty fell like a rotten tree before a gale. And the same tendency to break up into a number of warring states, and the same eruption of barbaric rulers, was displayed in East and West alike. In China, as in the Western Empire, faith had decayed. Mr. Fu ascribes much of the political nervelessness of China in this period to Epicureanism, arising, he thinks, out of the skeptical individualism of Lao Tse. This phase of division is known as the Three Kingdom period. The 4th century saw a dynasty of more or less civilized Huns established as rulers in the province of Shenxi. This Hunnish kingdom included not merely the north of China, but great areas of Siberia. Its dynasty absorbed the Chinese civilization, and its influence carried Chinese trade and knowledge to the Arctic Circle. Mr. Fu compares this Siberian monarchy to the Empire of Charlemagne in Europe. It was the barbarian becoming Chinized, as Charlemagne was a barbarian becoming Romanized. Out of a fusion of these Siberian and native North Chinese elements arose the Sui dynasty, which conquered the south. This Sui dynasty marks the beginning of a renaissance of China. Under a Sui monarch, the Luchu Isles were annexed to China, and there was a phase of great literary activity. The number of volumes at this time in the Imperial Library was increased, we're told, to 54,000. The dawn of the 7th century saw the beginning of the great Tang dynasty, which was to endure for 3 centuries. The Renaissance of China that began with Sui and culminated in Tang was, Mr. Fu insists, a real new birth. The spirit, he writes, was a new one. It marked the Tang civilization with entirely distinctive features. 4 main factors had been brought together and fused. First, Chinese liberal culture. Second, Chinese classicism. Third, Indian Buddhism. And fourth, northern bravery. A new China had come into being. The provincial system, the central administration, and the military organization of the Tang dynasty were quite different from those of their predecessors. The arts had been much influenced and revivified by Indian and Central Asiatic influences. The literature was no mere continuation of the old, it was a new production. The religious and philosophical schools of Buddhism were fresh features. It was a period of substantial change. It may be interesting to compare this making of China with the fate of the Roman Empire in her later days. As the Roman world was divided into the eastern and western halves, so was the Chinese world into the southern and the northern. The barbarians, in the case of Rome and in the case of China, made similar invasions. They established dominions of a similar sort. Charlemagne's empire corresponded to that of the Siberian dynasty, later Wei. The temporary recovery of the Western Empire by Justinian corresponded to the temporary recovery of the North by Liu Hu. The Byzantine line corresponded to the Southern dynasties, but from this point the 2 worlds diverged. China recovered her unity, Europe has still to do so. The dominions of the Emperor, Taizong, in 627, the second Tang monarch, extended southward into Annam and westward to the Caspian Sea. His southern frontier in that direction marched with that of Persia. His northern ran along the Altai from the Kyrgyz steppe, north of the desert of Gobi. But it didn't include Korea, which was conquered and made tributary by his son. This Tang dynasty civilized and incorporated into the Chinese race the whole of the southward population. And just as the Chinese of the North call themselves the men of Han, so the Chinese of the South call themselves the men of Tang. The law was codified, the literary examination system was revised, and a complete and accurate edition of all the Chinese classics was produced. To the court of Taizong came an embassy from Byzantium, and what's more significant, from Persia came a company of Nestorian missionaries. These later Taizong received with great respect. He heard them state the chief articles of their creed and ordered the Christian scriptures to be translated into Chinese for his further examination. In 638 he announced that he found the new religion entirely satisfactory and that it might be preached within the empire. He also allowed the building of a church and the foundation of a monastery. A still more remarkable embassy also came to the court of Taizong in the year 628, 5 years earlier than the Nestorians. This was a party of Arabs who came by sea to Canton in a trading vessel from Yanbu, the port of Medina in Arabia. Incidentally, it's interesting to know that there were such vessels engaged in an east and west trade at this time. These Arabs had been sent by that Mohammed we've already mentioned, who styled himself the Prophet of God, and the message they brought to Taizong was probably identical with the summons which was sent in the same year to the Byzantine Emperor Heraclius and to Kavad in Ctesiphon. But the Chinese monarch neither neglected the message, as Heraclius did, nor insulted the envoys after the fashion of the parricide Kavad. He received them well, expressed great interest in their theological views, and assisted them, it said, to build a mosque for the Arab traders in Canton, a mosque which survives to this day. It is one of the oldest mosques in the world.